Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Kees van Diemter about his recent book, Computational Models of Referring, which takes a close look at the generation of referring expressions in language, something that has historically presented important philosophical and practical challenges. In this interview, we discuss the goals of computational work in this area and how it can illuminate our understanding of human speakers' communicative capabilities. We consider what makes a referring expression efficient and appropriate, and we look at some notably difficult cases, including those in which speakers appeal to common knowledge about the world in order to successfully identify reference. I'm delighted to welcome Kees van Diemter to talk about his recent book, Computational Models of Referring. Kees, what motivated you to write this book?
I felt that there was a gap there in the literature. You can find, obviously, lots of journal papers, conference presentations about aspects of the problem of modeling how people refer. There's even a nice survey paper on the computational side of that problem. But no one had told the story from different points of view, bringing everything together from experimental psychology, from computing, indeed, from linguistics. And I felt that that could lead to a really new and interesting story, new questions and new answers here and there.
Yes, indeed. So what are the features of reference in particular as a topic that make it such an interesting challenge for this sort of integrated cognitive science approach?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've sometimes been surprised looking at parts of the literature about the sheer body of work that focuses on referring expressions. Why have people who are interested in language so often ended up focusing on reference? So you can start with philosophers, for example, going back to even the 19th century, right? Frege, Russell. When they started theorizing about language, very often they ended up saying more about referring expressions than about anything else. The famous examples like the King of France, right? What happens when we say that when France doesn't have a king, etc. Historically important example. So that's philosophers. But equally, if you look at psycholinguists, what parts of language they have studied a lot. And again, right, if you want to know how one speaker takes the knowledge of the hearer into account, then what people ended up looking at in many cases is what referring expressions the speaker produces and how the hearer understands them. So there's simply so much. And it's for a good reason, isn't it? Because reference seems to be so simple and so clear. So if you start to try to understand how language works, it's an obvious idea that you can have is let's start with referring expressions because we know exactly what they do. Their aim is for me to make clear to you what I'm talking about, what person, what car, what idea? That's the aim of a referring expression. So at least we understand that.
As you say, there's a great deal of philosophical history behind the topic, and there's now increasingly much experimental linguistic work that also touches upon this. How well do you feel that these approaches fit with the computational trend in work that's sort of central to the book?
At first sight, they don't match very well. I think on closer inspection, they fit quite well often. Let me give an example. In the computational literature, you seldom read about the Strauss and Russell debate in philosophy. On the other hand, if you look at computational algorithms, the algorithms that try to come to term with how people refer, it's quite clear that they use Strawson's approach, not Russell's approach. So Russell's approach basically was to say, when I have a referring expression, it makes a statement, right? When I say the King of France is bold, I say there exists one King of France, and yes, he is bold, right? That's basically, in a nutshell, Russell's position. Strawson's position was to distinguish between two different kinds of things that an utterance like that does. One is indeed making a statement. That's the bold part. The other is subtly different. It presupposes something, right? It doesn't assert that France has exactly one king. It rather assumes this, presupposes it, right? Yep. So that's basically the Strawson position. And if you look at algorithms that model how people speak, then you can see that same distinction there. So if you look at these computer programs that model human referring expressions generation, then they make use of two different databases. One database expresses what hearer and speaker share in terms of their information. The other has information that only the speaker possesses. So it's the former which you use to produce the referring expression itself, like the King of France, for example, or the cup on the table, or whatever it is. And it's the other database that you then use to convey additional information, like King of France is bold, or the cup on the table is mine, or whatever. Right?
Yeah.
So going back to your question, no one in the computational literature ever referred to the Russell-Strawson debate, and yet you can say in quite a clear-cut way what position computational algorithms take in that debate.
There are presumably a couple of different things that one could try to do computationally, one of which is to model human use of referring expressions, and another being to model how, if you will, one should use referring expressions, or referring expressions should be used by, say, an automated system to achieve maximal effect with maybe a human hearer.
Yes, absolutely.
What's the sort of balance of power between those two approaches in computational literature?
More emphasis on the former than on the latter, on the whole. So the bulk of work, certainly until recently, has focused on trying to model speakers, trying to simulate what speakers do when they refer. But there's a substantial and growing body of work that has taken the other perspective, the perspective where, as you say, you try to design algorithms that produce referring expressions that are optimal for hearers. Yeah. And it's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of computational work traditionally has a very practical context, right? System building, NLG systems, so systems that do natural language generation, all kinds of practical applications. And you would think, from that perspective, what you want is to produce useful expressions. Who cares what speakers do? All we care about is how whether hearers are going to understand what you say, right? And yet, if you look at the computational literature, it's the other way around. It has traditionally taken the speaker's perspective. if you look a little bit more closely, right, if you take out your magnifying glass, then for a long time, I suppose, people in the computational area didn't really ask your question. They didn't distinguish between the two perspectives. But if you read between the lines, and if you look at the first experiments that were then actually done, then yes, they took the speaker's perspective.
I guess there's a point of view that would say that you could achieve something that was beyond the scope of most NLG accomplishments if you were able just to model the speaker's behavior, normal human speaker's behavior. But do you see those as being, do you see human likeness as a route to that kind of, successful NLG system, or would you see those paths as diverging somewhere along the way?
I guess there are two possible answers, yes. I can definitely understand. If someone says my ultimate aim is to please hearers, right, to produce referring expressions that are good for hearers, but as a shortcut, I'm going to simulate the behavior of human speakers, well, that's acceptable, isn't it? That's, if you think people do this rather well, so why not imitate them? On the other hand, it is known that people are often far from optimal in how they refer. So ultimately, if you're interested in hearers understanding well, reliably, and quickly what you mean, then imitating speakers is not the best you can do. So this, for example, one line of work which is quite interesting, which one chapter of the book is about. So at some point, we'd done an experiment in which we had found out how people refer in some simple situations. Let's call them the tuna experiment. And people in our community, in the natural language generation community, sort of started to adopt that model. And what they did is organize an international competition in which people could submit their algorithms, right? And these algorithms were then tested on our corpus, tested in terms of how well did each algorithm simulate human referring behavior, okay? So some algorithms did better than others, right? And then next, what these people did is they compared these same algorithms in terms of how useful referring expressions that they produced are for hearers. And what they found that there's essentially no correlation between the two rankings, right? Some of the algorithms that did best in terms of simulation didn't do very well in terms of usefulness for the hearer at all, and the other way around.
Interesting. So when we say that the algorithms that are human-like aren't necessarily best for hearers, or when we say that human speakers aren't necessarily optimal in the way they use referring expressions, what kind of thing do we mean? Is it possible to point to examples of suboptimality from a communicative point of view, or is it something we'd rather know when we hear it?
Well, so one area where you see this is in fairly complicated situations where it's simply very difficult to keep track of all the different distractors that there are. So let me give you one example. If I try to point out to you where I live, maybe you're going to come over to our place to have dinner, right? Then as a first approximation, you might think, give the guy a unique referring expression. Tell him something that identifies the place, and that'll do, right? But actually, what we find is that a lot of the referring expressions that you're then going to produce, and some of these might easily be produced by people as well, are going to wrong-foot the hearer in a big way. So suppose I live in the longest street in Aberdeen, right? We live in Aberdeen, so suppose it's the longest street there, and suppose we live towards the end. If that's the case, then the street number alone identifies the house, okay? Yet it would be ridiculous to say that because you would have to know all of Aberdeen to find that house. Okay? So that shows that uniqueness alone is not enough. I'm not suggesting that human speakers would be quite as clumsy referring as I just was hypothetically, but it's an example of the kind of situation where you need quite an algorithmically smart algorithm to find the optimum, where you don't give people a ridiculous amount of information, but you give them enough so that they can quickly find the referent.
Yep. Leaping ahead in the book, you cite some examples on page 278 of where algorithms struggle to integrate common knowledge, which you could usefully use to refer.
Yes.
Where there's distinctions made between a human producing a description for Charles Darwin that said this person is considered the father of the modern theory of evolution due to his book on the origin of species. Whereas an algorithm might come up with this person died in Down, was known for On the Origin of Species, and named not Ophthalmus.
Yes, these are not shining examples of how the algorithm behaves, are they? These are cases where the human beats the computer hands down, right? So we know this because we presented outputs of various algorithms to human judges, and also we gave them human-constructed referring expressions. And this is actually a domain where we're not able to do nearly as well even as human speakers.
And presumably this problem of trying to integrate the common knowledge is kind of, or aspects of common knowledge, or what is presumed common knowledge, are entering into that problem all the time. The address case you gave, presumably the issue is that our process for locating an address doesn't involve considering whether the number of the house is unique and working it out from there.
Right.
But the computer has to be equipped with that kind of knowledge in order to make human-like referring expressions, or referring expressions that are comprehensible to hearers.
Exactly, exactly. So the work you were just referring to, which refers to famous people like Darwin, takes that problem as its starting point, as it were. So the research question there was very much, out of all this information about Darwin, which facts are worth mentioning? And the research hypothesis, one of the research hypotheses here was that if a fact is relatively well known about Darwin among a large set of people, then that makes the fact more worth mentioning. That was only one of the heuristics that we used, because the fact that Darwin had two legs, right, is widely known, or at least widely assumed, and yet it's not very mentionable. So the heuristic I'm referring to here is not the only one, but it's one of the heuristics, one of the requirements, if you like, that the output of this algorithm has to pass in order to be generated, right? So the problem for my colleague Roman Kotlak was to find out what information is likely to be widely known, right?
Yeah.
So that's a specific version of the common knowledge problem. It's not exactly the problem of do I know what you know and that you know that I know, and right? It's not exactly that problem, but it's related, okay? So what Roman did is, given a fact about, for example, Darwin, he used search on the World Wide Web to find out how often this fact was mentioned somewhere. And the more often it was mentioned, the more likely it is that the fact is widely known. That was the reason. So all of these are assumptions up to this point, right? But of course, what Roman did was then ultimately build these heuristics into his algorithms and evaluate the output of the algorithm. Right? So the output would be descriptions like the ones you just read out. And then human judges, of course, different judges, right, would judge the output. And that's where we found the things that we were just talking about. So that humans can actually do this incomparably well, right? So this is a case, going back to your earlier question, if you want to build an algorithm for referring to famous people, you could do worse than imitate human speakers. It's a very high level of achievement.
So presumably there's also abstractly a parallel between this question of which of these properties will we talk about, which of these are likely to be helpful in enabling a hearer to identify the person we're talking about, which exactly. of these things are commonly known about the speaker. To the more specific case talked about earlier in the book about salience properties or the relative salience of properties in their usefulness in picking out a referent. Do you see a parallel there?
Let's see. Are you talking about algorithms like the incremental algorithm, which use an order, right? A preference order of attributes. Is that the kind of salience you're?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you make the distinction between using attributes that would be maximally effective in pruning the search space, in excluding possible candidate reference, and algorithms that refer or choose attributes in a way that's what we expect to encounter as language users.
Right. Probably the answer is no. If you look at, maybe it's good to introduce that with a few more words. So, yeah, one of the best known algorithms in this area, one of the oldest, is the incremental algorithm. And basically what it does is very simple. It starts from an ordering of attributes from sort of most salient, as you say, right, to least salient. At the top will be things like color and then size, right? And then at the bottom, there might be things like, I don't know, some really unimportant stuff, right? The stuff that's quite unlikely to be mentioned, okay? So the algorithm goes through that list from the top and asks at each point. So it starts asking this from the very first, very most salient attribute. It asks, if I use this attribute, for example, color, is that going to make any headway, right? In other words, can I apply it to my referent, for example, by saying red? And if I do so, am I going to get rid of any distractors? In other words, if everything in the domain is red, then that's not a very good idea. Right? So if that happens, I go to the next attribute, size maybe, and so on, until I've accumulated enough attributes to identify my referent. That's in a nutshell, right, the incremental algorithm. Now, so the question that we're talking about, the question that you're raising, is what is this preference order? What does it mean to be at the top or at the bottom of that? Is it maybe, does it have something to do with what property gives me most mileage in terms of ruling out reference? One reason why the two are very different is the preference order is going to be always the same, right? So if I have a domain which everything is red, right? The incremental algorithm sort of doesn't know about that. It will still start looking at color, right? Because it's up there in the preference order always. Whether or not it's going to remove any distractors. So that's one reason why the two are different, the salience that you're talking about in the preference order and the kind of different kind of salience that might tell you whether a property is going to narrow down your search. But there's different stuff as well. If you look at concrete examples, for example, referring to famous people, if you had their driver's license, right? That would narrow down the search. That would be rather good. And yet, of course, driver's license is not going to be up there in the preference order, right? because that property isn't mentioned very often, and right? And of course, you can ask further, why not, right? And that's actually where it gets really interesting, because of course psychologists have a lot to say about these things, right? They have all kinds of ideas about why, for example, indeed, color is so high up there in that preference order. Color, apparently, in human perception, has a sort of directness that most other qualities, even visual qualities, lack. Codability is the term that's often associated with that notion. So colors are highly codable. Size is also quite highly codable, etc.
Yeah.
Right. Driver's license a little bit less so. So presumably we're talking here about properties of our brain that, you know, our ancestors long ago had already, right, and they didn't know about driver's license.
Presumably, this issue of codability could manifest itself for two different reasons. One, because it's convenient to us as speakers to talk about properties that are really salient to us.
Yeah.
Or because we're being cooperative and we know that, or we assume that properties that are really salient to us are also really salient to the hearer. So it's in some sense mutually evident that the object is red or blue or big, in a way that, you know, other properties of it maybe aren't quite so obviously mutually evident. So I guess a question would be, do you take a view on whether this is really a hearer thing or a speaker thing, or both?
I guess for the concrete questions that we're looking at the moment, the two are very difficult to tease apart, aren't they? Because you and I are both human, therefore, if psychologists are right about codability, both of us will have color somewhere very high up, right at the top of our preference order, to use that term. So it's then very difficult, right? If I speak, then giving color that prominence is both easy for me as a speaker and easier for you as a hearer. So that makes it very difficult to say, very difficult to determine whether I as a speaker do it for you or for me. There's, of course, a whole body of work associated with the term audience design, and there's a fair amount of stuff about it in the book, which sort of asks versions of your question. Yes, so for this and that behavior in, let's say, speaking behavior, do we do it for the hearer, or do we do it because we can't help ourselves, so to speak? Sometimes it's possible to tease these two apart, sometimes it isn't.
Turning, if I may, to this idea of sort of cooperativity, a point you make is that it's sometimes helpful in discussing this to appeal to ideas like Grice's maxims of communication.
Yeah.
But in common with a lot of practical approaches based on linguistic principles, would it be fair to say you see those as, you know, potentially helpful but underspecified when push comes to shove?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think that's a view that many people will agree on, that the Gricean maxims, right? So ideas that you need truthful, other things being equal, that you need to sort of give the right amount of information, that you give relevant information. Okay, so if you read Grice's papers about that and further developments of them, relevance theory and stuff, then all of that is very sensible. I think researchers in different areas agree about that. But underspecified, indeed. So to give the right amount of information, not too much and not too little, well, that doesn't tell us very much, does it? Right. So, for example, concretely, going back to some of the things we've already talked about, go back to my example of the place where I live. Okay. If we read the Gricean maxim of quantity, which says don't give more information than required, if I give you the house number and the street number and maybe the name of the neighborhood as well, is that a breach? of the Gricean maxim? Am I giving you too much? Or should we interpret it more cleverly and say, no, the right amount of information doesn't mean the amount of information that logically identifies the referent, but it means the right amount of information that allows you to find the referent in reasonable time. So if the latter, if that's what Grice meant, well, yeah, that you need a lot of space to write that down, right, and nail it down in its particulars. And, of course, a lot of those particulars we, as researchers, don't know yet. And some of this research is trying to flesh them out. Yeah, so we're trying to make the Gricean maxim more precise.
I guess a related aspect of that is the difficulty of being able to produce something that's optimal in that sort of narrow traditional Gricean sense, given a large domain of potential reference. But I think you characterize that algorithm as being a pretty unwieldy it's pretty much unworkable to come up with guaranteed minimal descriptions.
Yeah.
So presumably, as speakers, we want to be a bit selfish sometimes and just, you know, produce something that'll do, because actually it's less effort for us, even if it involves us saying a few more words than we would otherwise need to.
Well, as you sort of implied earlier, the two are rather difficult to tease apart, aren't they? So here's a speaker, and suppose there's only one red object in the room, and they say, my red chair. So the word chair doesn't add information, the word my doesn't add information, because there's only one red object, sort of salient enough to be a plausible word. So suppose the speaker produces a rather longer expression than necessary. Do they do this because they can't help themselves? Or do they do this because a little bit of a redundancy can help the speaker? It's very difficult to tease these things apart. So in recent experiments with a number of colleagues of mine, so Roger van Hompel in Dundee, Emil Kramer in Tilburg, Albert Gatt in Malta, so we're trying to tease these things apart a little bit.
So are there circumstances under which speakers are particularly likely to produce referring expressions that seem to us fine as hearers, but are technically, you know, violating Gricean quantity by being unnecessarily verbose?
Well, certainly the opposite happens a lot. For example, children learn to speak, it's well known that they underspecify quite a lot. Children below a certain age are not very good at assessing the other guy's knowledge often. And you see this in the way they speak, concretely in the way they refer, because they often don't give you enough information. But also, indeed, children also show this opposite behavior sometimes, of, for example, where they could have said it simply, they give you more information. They say the red chair or something like that, right? So children in particular show this behavior where they apparently find it difficult to find that golden middle where they give you just the right of information. Sometimes there's not enough, so you wonder what chair. Sometimes they give you a little bit too much. But of course, so that's you see that in children a lot. And I know of research that there's quite a lot of research going on. People are starting to get very interested in the question whether people on the autism spectrum show some of the same behavior. But those are the jury is still out on that one, I believe.
Interesting. So in those cases, I mean, there are a couple of kinds of egocentricity that could be going on, in the sense of, you know, giving the wrong amount of information that makes it impossible to find the speaker's intended referent.
Yeah.
And presumably there's also, I don't know, would you characterize it as egocentric also if somebody describes an object by all the attributes that they, you know, they perceive it to have, even though you don't need all those in order to identify it.
Exactly. This is a really interesting area from a point of view of experimental setup. So historically, there's a line of research in which, so Boas Kezar is one of the proponents of that line of work, where people have sort of systematically shown or argued that they had shown rather stark limitations of people's ability, speakers' ability, to take the knowledge of the other guy into account. Right? So, for example, there's one famous paper, Wu et al., not so long ago, where the experimenters showed that speakers used proper names rather often, where the hearer could not know what the proper name refers to. Okay? I could say more about the setup. So these were sort of artificial proper names, right, which had to be learned during the experiment. A very clever setup, okay? You can probably imagine that if you do that cleverly, then there can be proper names where I know that you cannot know what it refers to, okay? So lo and behold, these people found that speakers misuse proper names in that way rather a lot. But then came along other researchers who looked at their data and said, wait, yes, these proper names are used, but they are almost always used in over-specification. So they did all kinds of follow-up experiments with hearers in which they found out that these proper names were never essential for understanding what the discourse was about.
So concretely, you're looking at a situation where I know that this guy's name is Fred, I know that you don't know his name is Fred, so rather than just identify him as Fred, I identify him as Fred, that man over there with the glasses.
Exactly. So it's a little bit as if you're teaching me, you're informing me that the guy is also named Fred. Exactly. So in the first paper, people said, oh, you're doing that incorrectly. You shouldn't have said Fred. And the second set of researchers said, wait a minute. No, that's not what's going on. The word Fred is there not to refer, but to teach you something.
Interesting. Yes. So what we find is that the what seem to be referring expressions can also be doing double duty a lot of the time. That exactly. You know, we're not only pointing out reference, but we're also conveying something else about it, either another attribute that might be useful, like a name, or maybe our attitude towards it, or something of that nature.
Exactly. So there's this famous paper, Dale and Reiter, 1995. That's the paper in which the incremental algorithm was first presented in a journal paper. They also have these nice examples of exactly what you just said. So their example is, one of their examples is, please don't sit at the newly painted table, where newly painted is not there to tell you what table, but to explain why it's not such a good idea to sit there. So that's what you just called double duty.
You go on in the second half of the book to discuss some extensions to the sort of simpler problem of generating referring expressions and some of the challenges that arise. And you discuss proper names there. Another issue you discuss, which I'd like to talk about a little, is how one refers to sets of objects other than simply by stringing together a set of descriptions that would work for referring to each of them individually.
Yeah.
That seems like an even more complex problem. Is that actually the case?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah. So, for example, the search space is much larger, right? If you have n objects in your domain, you have 2 to the n, to the power of n, subset of that domain. There are a lot of distractors there to be ruled out, many more than if you're only interested in single individuals.
And presumably also a lot of descriptions in play, or potential descriptions.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, also from a linguistic perspective, yeah. So sometimes you can get away with a very simple referring expression like the cups or the chairs or the red chairs, right? But if the the two chairs have different colors, then you can't do that. You may have to say the red and the green chair. So all kinds of things going on there, right? So you might first try to generate the red chair and then the green chair so you can sort of aggregate them together. And yeah, so there's lots of additional things going on over and above the ability to identify.
Again, this seems like a problem that humans are able to solve, if not optimally, then at least pretty well. And you give an example of page 186, where you note that it would be rather more natural to describe two dogs, one of which is a white poodle and one of which is a black Alsatian, as the white poodle and the black Alsatian, rather than using a form like the dogs that are white or Alsatians and also the dogs that are black or poodles.
Yeah.
Or indeed, the dogs that are black or white and Alsatians or poodles.
Yeah.
Even under circumstances when those would all pick out the same set.
Yeah.
So presumably that's something that requires a lot of refinement on the computational side if your objective is to produce human-like referring behavior.
Yes, exactly. And often brevity is your first attempt, isn't it? So Horacek's work, that's what he was sort of referring there mostly, Helmut Horacek in Germany, DFKI. So yes, he used sort of simple, you might call them theorem-proving rules that allow you to simplify a given referring expression so that you get a shorter one. And by and large, shorter ones are a little bit easier to process, a little bit more natural. That's a first stab at the problem. It's not always best, but it comes fairly close. Yeah, so there are a lot of these additional problems. So another one is, so the one that my colleague Albert Gatt worked on a lot. So that's the problem of, so if you have a complicated referring expression, where you say something like, you want to refer to two people, okay? Of course, it can be more than two. You probably don't want to say something like the Italian and the cook, right? Even though the Italian might be a very efficient way to refer to one of the two people, and the cook might be a very efficient way to refer to the other, right? If you did this, you would be solving each of the two problems in a good way, but you would be solving the combined problem in a terrible way. What you want to say is something like the Italian and the Spaniard, right? That's much better. That was his intuition, and indeed we were able to confirm that idea, right? That coherence, the internal coherence of a plural referring expression, is a very important factor in its acceptability.
Yeah, and presumably this internal coherence is helpful for reasons that, again, aren't really captured by any of the obvious things we would say about, you know, being efficient in narrowing down the search space in principle. But
exactly.
You know, it has to do with how we actually process those expressions.
Exactly, yes. It can be neutral in terms of efficiency and brevity and all that. Yes.
Another problem you discuss that I found very interesting is how we use gradable properties in referring. Because I'm interested in how it's getting slightly more of a handle on that in linguistics. But what are the challenges in trying to integrate gradable properties within the kinds of computational models that you're discussing?
Right. So one challenge is to decide whether to use them at all, right? Do you want to say, what's a good example here? The man who is, you know, 6 foot tall, or do you want to say the tall man, right? That's one question. Another question is, suppose you do want to use a gradable term like tall, then, right, do you want to say big or tall, or right? So my colleague Meg Mitchell, who did her PhD here, focused particularly on questions of that kind. In reality, if you focus on a word like tall, right, or let's say size, okay, let's say size, but other attributes have this same internal structure very often. Simple algorithms and simple accounts more generally pretend sort of that this is one unanalyzed attribute. But of course, in reality, a thing has different dimensions, right? Size is composed of two or three dimensions, right? So if I stand in front of a tall building, well, I'm using the word tall now already, but it has three dimensions. I might refer to it as the tall building or as the large building. The depth of the building would be a little bit less likely to be used in isolation. So her question is, so which of these do we actually use in a given case? So she used machine learning and other techniques to answer that question. So to go back to your take on this, one challenge is, should I use gradable terms at all? Another is, which ones? And then the third one is, how do they combine?
Yeah. Our time is running a little short, so I'd like to wrap up by asking what you see as being the greatest challenges to face this research area on computational modeling of reference in the immediate future.
Okay, let me make a list. I'll try to keep each point a little bit brief. One is collaboration. So when we refer, we often do this, of course, in dialogue. And in dialogue, speakers rely on a comeback from the hearer, right? So we don't always get it right immediately, but we wait for a response and then we add information if necessary. So that's what people call collaboration. And people have started, as Alexander Koller and others, Daoufi, a lot of people have started to model that computationally. That's very challenging and very interesting. So that's one challenge. A very different challenge is other types of noun phrases. So going back to the beginning of our conversation, so why referring expressions? It seems to me that, yes, referring expressions are sort of a very clear case of how noun phrases can be used. So how about others? If you put aside so this whole book with all these approaches and you ask, right, changing the topic, how do we make an algorithm that produces indefinite descriptions, quantified descriptions? There's huge literature in theoretical linguistics and formal semantics, like this famous book by Peters and Westerstall, right? With formal theories about quantification. Do we know anything about algorithms that produce these when the quantifier is not already in the input? I think we don't, right? So, for example, if you have a natural language generation program that starts from sensor data or something like that, weather data maybe, okay? Lots of numbers, and that's your input for generating a weather report. Do we know how to go from those numbers to expressions like everywhere or in some places? I think our knowledge of that is very limited, and it will be very interesting to see how work on referring expression generation might generalize to quantification, indefinites, generics, that kind of thing. So that will be my second challenge. The third challenge is to move on from the what to the how, if you like. What I mean by this is the following. The algorithms that are described in the book and tested in all these experiments, at very best, what we find is that a particular algorithm does a pretty good job at simulating human behavior. That's at best because, as we've discussed, in complicated situations, these algorithms don't do very well yet. Okay? So at best, they simulate well. But do they work in a way that actually resembles what goes on in the human brain? We don't know yet. The book contains one or two studies where questions of that kind have started to be addressed. Most recently, people look at brain scans of different kinds to see what happens. And brain researchers think they've discovered an NREF effect. They think they know where in the brain reference happens and when it happens, so to speak, the time course of the phenomenon is. But that work, like a lot of brain research on language, is still in its infancy. And it would be extremely interesting to add that wet kind of research, if you like, to the computational work and the other experiments that have already been done. So those would be the three challenges that come to mind at the moment. There are the more obvious challenges that if you go through the book, then the algorithms that are discussed early on are typically very well tested, and we know a lot about them, right? We know how well they model human behavior. We often know how well they suit readers or hearers. But if you go through the book towards the end, where situations become much more complicated, right? The speaker doesn't quite know, the hearer knows, or that kind of difficulty, then those algorithms have not been tested with the same rigor yet. So is that sort of more humbler work, a lot of which also needs to still be done.
Which of these directions, if any, does your own work take you in the at the moment?
Ah, well, a different one. So at the moment, I'm very interested in East Asian languages. You may be familiar with this whole debate, which goes back a very long time, both in the West and in the East, if you like, where there is this idea that different languages, or speakers of different languages perhaps, make the trade-off between clarity and brevity in different ways. I'm using Gricean terms here, right? So the terms that have sometimes been used here is the distinction between hot and cool languages. So a hot language is a language that makes everything very specific, right? And doesn't keep the hearer guessing and doesn't let context play a huge role. A cold language or a cool language is one that does rely strongly on context for disambiguation and clarification, right? So there's this old idea. I think Huang is a famous reference for that. The idea that languages such as Mandarin are at the extreme cool end of that spectrum, whereas English is much further to the hot end, right? My native language, Dutch, is also supposed to be closer to that end. Partly because I'm learning Mandarin. So my research often brings me to that country, to China, and so I started to learn Mandarin, and I started to be very intrigued by, well, among other things, how reference works in Mandarin. So I've just returned from a sabbatical in China, where we've done experiments sort of following in the track of the tuna experiments, right? Where we try to figure out how Mandarin speakers behave, right? So there are all kinds of questions that you see coming here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, do Mandarin speakers underspecify more than English speakers? I'm not so sure that they do. I can say more, but...
So it sounds like fascinating work, and I very much look forward to hearing more about it in the near future. But now our time's up, so I have to say, Kees van Diemte, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. That was a really intriguing conversation, and I'll end up thinking probably quite a bit about the questions that you've asked.
I've been talking to Kees van Diemte about computational models of referring. This is Chris Cummins from New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.